the summer of 1526, he's printing and smuggling Bibles. So there's this continuous flow. The Bishop of London finds out that it's coming to England, and he buys up, goes to Packington and buys up all the copies, and then he burns them.
Hello and welcome to each and every one of you who are tuning in and listening to this podcast by Lineage Journey. Today we have a special guest. I'm actually down here in Australia at Melbourne, in Melbourne at the AYC Adventist Youth for Christ Conference. And I'm here with Suki. She is part of the Lineage team. You've probably seen her work on our website. Maybe you've read her book, Sisters in Arms, also Bringers of the Dawn. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you for having me.
So, and in your neck of the woods as well.
Yes.
So today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite reformers, and I think one of yours as well. So we're going to be looking at William Tyndale. William Tyndale, I think, had a profound impact on the English language, English Reformation, and all these things. So we want to unpack that a little bit more. For those of you who are familiar with Lineage, we are a series of videos as well. And we did do an episode on William Tyndale in season one back in 2017 that you can go and watch. It's only 5 minutes. So we're going to delve into his life in a little bit more detail here. So before we kind of, well, as we're going in, tell us a little bit from your reading, what did 16th century or the 1500s in England look like when William Tyndale was growing up religiously, maybe economically, and, you know, what was it like as a young man growing up in England at that time?
So Tyndale was born around 1494. Mm-hmm. And just before that, in 1485, there'd been a change of the guard in terms of the monarchy.
Okay.
So that was when Richard III met Henry VII or Henry Tudor at the Battle of Bosworth Field. And up to that point, there had been the Cousins War, the War of the Roses with the Lancastrians, the Yorkists, right? So the two roses, red for Lancaster and white for York. And then there is the Battle of Bosworth Field. Henry defeats Richard, the last of the Yorkists brothers, and he takes the throne. Henry was Lancastrian. His claim to the throne was really dodgy. Well, not dodgy, but tenuous. So he takes over, and suddenly there's the Tudors. And the Tudors worked really hard to establish their claim to the throne.
Okay.
So when William Tyndale was born, he was born into a world where there was some sense of political stability, because you don't have people killing each other over the throne. But also this really kind of stressed out king trying to hold on to his throne and his claim to the throne.
Okay.
And he grew up during the reign of Henry VII. Henry VII was a man who was known to be very exacting. So he hoarded his money. He was very spendthrift, and he taxed quite heavily. So economically, England was not really going through a very good spell at that time. Henry was also known for taxing people and then throwing people in jail. So there was a lot of fear among the peasants. From what I've read, Tyndale was a yeoman farmer. So not really peasant class, not really gentry ability, but, you know, middle class, upper middle class. So they would have had a comfortable life, but they would have had taxes. One really interesting fact of history is when
Henry VII
came in, he brought a mercenary army. And they brought what was known as the sweating sickness, where you woke up in the morning sweating, and by lunchtime you were dead. Wow. And so there was disease. There was, you know, crop failure, rain. You know, sometimes it would rain when it was not supposed to rain. So life in the 1500s in England was hard. It was hard for, especially hard for peasants. And then the yeoman farmer class would have also suffered with crop failures. And you're also living in England, in Europe, during a time when the Black Plague is still prevalent. The Black Plague changed the face of Europe. You know, so people are struggling with, you know, high price for wheat. There's a demand for, like, labor. The price of labor is going up. So economically, it was unstable. politically, England was grappling for stability under this new king, these Tudors. So it was interesting times to grow up in. And depending on the kind of loyalties that Tyndale's parents had,
it could be tied either way.
You know, there could have just been still some lingering, either this sense of triumph, oh, the Lancastrians got the throne, or a sense of, oh, York was defeated and now we have this pretender. Okay. So
England's now, it's fully Catholic though, right?
Fully Catholic.
Fully Catholic, okay.
Very, very Catholic.
Yeah. So he grows up, he studies.
Right.
Where does he study? What does he study?
So he goes to Oxford. He was at Oxford for a period of time. And then during his stay at Oxford, he discovered Erasmus's translation of the Bible. And I think we can kind of go into that a little bit, because he discovers Erasmus's translation of the Bible. And you have to understand that during this period of time, England was largely illiterate and the Bible was in Latin. And the only copy of the Bible was the Vulgate, which was the official church copy, which was translated by Jerome in the 4th century BC. And so you read the Vulgate, and the Vulgate translated things in a very specific way that played into the doctrinal understanding of the church. So, for example, in the book of Mark, when Jesus starts his ministry, Jesus says, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." That's what we read in our Bible today. The Vulgate translated that, "Do penance." So do penance, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.
Okay. And I think the words for church or congregation was to signify.
Yes, the church as well. So here, you know, do penance. And then Erasmus comes along and he decides, well, the Bible needs a better translation. He doesn't translate it into the vernacular, because that's not something that's really sanctioned. But he translates it into Latin from the original. And he changes the meaning. So now, instead of do penance, it says turn your heart, which is repentance. And so during this period of time, what Erasmus's Bible did was shift spirituality from a outward ritualistic to something inside out. So now you have these reformers reading and thinking about transformation and change of heart in Jesus. And it's everything's shifting. So Tyndale starts preaching this at Oxford, and Oxford is a hotbed of Catholicism. It's not somewhere that you'd want to preach this. And he starts getting persecuted. So he moves to Cambridge, and he continued his education at Cambridge. And while he was at Cambridge, he meets Thomas Bilney, who was probably one of the leading proponents of the English Reformation at that time.
We need to do a podcast on him.
That's right. So meets Bilney, meets John Frith, who's also just this brilliant mathematician. And Frith, Tyndale, and Bilney, along with a whole bunch of others, they start studying the Bible. So Tyndale kind of started off his education at Oxford, and then he transferred to Cambridge.
So he does both.
He does both.
Okay. So Cambridge had more of a stronger Reformation?
Cambridge was the hotbed of Reformation.
Okay.
Oxford was Catholic through and through.
Okay.
Cambridge was where the Reformation started, actually, with Bilney. And I mean, when we do our podcast on Bilney, we can talk about it. It's really interesting how they started it up right there. But okay. Yeah.
So his life wasn't that long.
No.
I think he was 44 years, if I'm correct.
Probably.
Something around there.
He died in 1536.
36, yeah.
1494, yeah. So he was in his 40s.
Yeah. So somewhere in his 20s, he gets a calling.
Yes.
To translate Erasmus's into the vernacular.
Yep.
How does that start?
Yeah, so he leaves. So he's all fired up about... At that time, they were not called reformers or Protestants. They were called evangelicals in England. So he's all fired up about evangelicalism, all fired up about righteousness by faith. He's discovered this. And he finishes his time at Cambridge and he gets a job with Sir John Walsh back in Gloucestershire. He was born in Gloucestershire. He goes back to John Walsh's home in Little Sodbury Hall. And it's really interesting because... He was learning all these things and he just felt this compulsion to share it. And John Walsh's Lord of the Manor would have an open table. And so he'd have a lot of the local clergy at his table. And Tyndale would come to the table with his little copy of the New Testament And during dinner, when the clergy was talking about things, Tyndale would like open up his Bible and start preaching to them from the Bible. And they got really upset because in their minds, you didn't like reading the Bible is almost tantamount to heresy. Mm-hmm. And so here's this man with his Bible, you know, at the dinner table, and he's challenging the views of the church because the views of the church are going against the Bible. Mm-hmm. And they're telling him, how dare you? And in one conversation, Tyndale goes, I defy the Pope. Like, so it started there. Then he started preaching at St. Adeline's Church, which was where John Walsh went to church as well. They gave him the pulpit. And he's preaching about righteousness by faith. He's preaching about how all you need is Jesus. And the peasants, especially the tenant farmers, Sir John Walsh's mm-hmm. tenant farmers, are just soaking this in. But the local clergy are realizing that he's undermining what mm-hmm. they're doing, undermining their mm-hmm. power over the people. And it's really interesting. Tyndale would not just preach at St. Adeline's. He would go out into the fields. And if he sees this group of farmers farming their land, taking a break during lunchtime, he'd go and talk to them under a tree and just, he was just out there with the people. And so the priests saw this happening and they were like, this is not good enough. So they started mingling with the people. It's really interesting. In England during this time, it seems to me that everything happened in an alehouse. So you'd go to the alehouse for news because they would sing ballads in the alehouse, and most of the ballads, that's how they sang the news in England during this time. And so they would gather the people at the alehouse and they'd start tearing down. The clergy would gather at the alehouse and they'd start tearing down Tyndale. And Tyndale felt like for every seed he planted, four or five clergymen would come and uproot it. Hmm. Kind of harking back to the parable of the sword. And then he felt that he's not progressing. He wants the people to know this, but he just felt like he was a lone voice trying to counteract so many people. And then he realized, I know how to solve this problem. I'm going to take the Bible to the people. So bypass the clergy, bypass even himself as a preacher, and put the Bible in the people's hands. That's how it started.
Fascinating. I think it goes along with the idea that something written will outlast something that's just spoken.
That's right.
Or something that's got there's an actual resource. I mean, in this day and age, it could be something, it could be a digital resource, but he creates something that can outlast his presence.
Right.
And continue. So, okay, so he's got this passion to share the Bible, but there's a problem because the Bible's banned in, I mean,
right. So
far he's done Latin.
Yes.
But he wants to make it so that the peasants can understand, but
you couldn't translate the, yes. And if I remember correctly, it was a law that was put in just after Wycliffe, probably around the reign of Richard II, where you could not translate the Bible into English. You couldn't read it in English.
For any of us to grasp the reality of a law banning the Bible.
Yeah.
And you are a Christian or whatever you are, a Catholic, but you've never read the Bible.
Right. And I think especially in England, it was really a reaction to Wycliffe.
Yeah.
Because Wycliffe's entire ministry was really an attack against the establishment of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at a time when the church was, you know, there was a schism in the church was falling apart, but then there was the plague. There was so much social and political upheaval in Europe during that time. And here's Wycliffe standing up and challenging the authority of the Pope and the clergy in Parliament.
Hmm.
And he had such powerful backers. He was John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, was his patron. Edward III, the King Edward III, was not, you know, he didn't openly support him, but he was favorable towards
him.
And so as a backlash, when Richard II took the throne, there was this sense of no English Bible, just a pushback against Lollards and everything to do with Wycliffe. And then that was never repealed. So though during the time of Henry VIII, it wasn't that, you know, people were like standing up on the rooftops talking about not translating the Bible. It was just a law that was put in place in the aftermath of Wycliffe, and it was just never repealed. But it was also the kind of law that, you know, if you tested it,
there will be
consequences. Yeah.
So you said earlier that society was illiterate at this time, pretty much.
Yes. Yes. Most peasants couldn't read.
Okay.
And the gentry and the nobility could read. But even among them, it was limited to scholars. It's really interesting, but before the Renaissance, there was just being, if you're a gentleman, being illiterate was fashionable before the Renaissance. After the Renaissance, you had suddenly this change of, oh, being literate and being noble is fashionable. That idea didn't trickle into England until the reign of Henry VIII.
Oh, wow.
Up till that point, there was this sense of, oh, if you're noble, then you make your mark on the battlefield. You're not an intellectual. It's really interesting. You see this even in France. William Farel's, you know, he's a French reformer. When he told his father that he wanted to go to the Sorbonne to study, his father was horrified because as a son of a nobleman, he was supposed to go and make his mark on the battlefield, not go and become an intellectual. Wow. So you see this in Europe. Yeah, and the tide really changed during the time of Henry VIII. In France, it changed, started to change during the time of Francis I. There were these intellectual kings that were influenced by the Renaissance. They started bringing in poets and thinkers into their court. They started reading and writing. So that's when it changed. And so illiteracy was just, you know, the way of life at that time.
So he has this translation. He starts it in England?
Yes, actually he does.
He does start. Does he have to fund this, or is he just kind of writing on his own pieces of paper for now?
So he realizes that he needs a sponsor to do this because he can't work and do it. Besides which, it was getting really dangerous for him to stay with Sir John Walsh because he'd been preaching in the entire area around the Shire. And so he was coming to be known as this anti-papist. And so it was not safe for John Walsh. It was not safe for him. And he felt he needed a sponsor because he wanted to do this full time. So he goes to London and he goes to the Bishop of London, Tunstall, and he says to him, well, there was an opening at that time for a chaplain, the bishop's chaplain. And he applies to be bishop's chaplain in the hopes that the bishop would then, you know, the chaplaincy position would be a cover for funding him for translating the Bible. And Tunstall was, he was not... He just didn't, you know, when I read about him, I like to think he wanted to be Switzerland, you know,
tried to play every time.
Right. So he did not want, you know, Tyndale in his house trying to translate the Bible. And then as the story goes, Tyndale, you know, he's rejected. He's really downcast. He's walking along the Thames and he meets Humphrey Monmouth, who is an evangelical. And Humphrey Monmouth was a merchant. And Monmouth says, you know, what's happening? Why are you so downcast? And he tells Monmouth the story and Monmouth is like, well, come live with me and I'll sponsor you.
Oh, wow.
And so he goes and lives with Monmouth for a period of time with John Frith. And he and Frith, more than Tyndale, John Frith was a brilliant linguist.
Wasn't he martyred later on?
He was martyred too. And so So Frith was martyred before Tyndale. And so Frith and Tyndale start translating the Bible in England. And then things start getting really, you know, there's this spate of burnings and the English Inquisition happens and people are being burnt as heretics. And he realizes that he can't stay in England. He can't sustain this. And so he escapes to Hamburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
He leaves. So apart from the law about you can't translate the Bible, what other issues, if there are any, does King Henry VIII have with Tyndale?
So when Tyndale left, he probably left around 1523, 1524.
Okay.
And at that time, King Henry was, he'd been on the throne for a while. He ascended the throne in 1509. And he was still hopeful that his queen, Catherine of Aragon, would give him a son. But it was a dicey situation, right? And it's really, first of all, to kind of understand this, you have to understand the mindset of the king. When Henry's father took the throne, his first order of business was to secure a Tudor heir. England had been through a civil war for almost three decades, and they needed that to end. There could not be a question about succession. once the Tudors secured the throne, they needed a Tudor heir and a Tudor spare so that the throne could be secure. And of course, Arthur Tudor was born, and then Henry was the spare. Arthur dies, probably of tuberculosis or the sweating sickness. Henry becomes king. And so Henry's been through this. He understands the importance of securing not just one, but a couple of heirs.
Mm.
He marries Arthur's wife, Catherine, and she goes on to have 6 miscarriages.
Wow.
Well, not all of them are miscarriages. So some miscarriages, some are infant deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And they have one child, Mary, and she's obviously a female. In Catherine of Aragon's mind, that wasn't a problem. She was the daughter of Isabella of Castile. And Isabella of Castile was co-regent with her husband, Ferdinand. They went out on the battlefield together. So a queen was not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But in England, they'd never had a queen regnant. Hmm. And there was no sense of no English nobleman would have supported a queen. So Henry understood that if he didn't produce a male heir, a legitimate male heir, because he had an illegitimate male heir, if he didn't produce a legitimate male heir, then the throne would be up for grabs. So this is the situation. And then he casts his eye on Anne Boleyn. Now he's trying to get a divorce from Catherine. And he wants support. He's trying to gather support, especially scholarly support.
Mm-hmm.
Tyndale at this time is on the continent translating the Bible, and he hears about it, and he just openly denounces it.
Hey.
And Henry was somebody that you couldn't tell him no. And you couldn't tell him that what he was doing was wrong. He was really vain.
Hmm.
And so he was very upset at Tyndale, to put it mildly.
So that issue only comes once he's in Europe.
Yes.
So while he's in England, he can't translate. There's pressure.
Yes.
So he leaves.
Yes.
But then he voices his opinions about the king's divorce, remarriage that's imminent.
Yes.
And that even puts him in further into the bad books.
That's right. That would have been in the 15, you know, Henry married Anne Boleyn in 1533.
Oh, okay. So beheaded, it's close to his death.
Beheaded her in 1536. She was beheaded in May of 1536. Tyndale died in November.
Hmm.
So this would have been in the 1530s when everything was going on.
Hmm.
After he had released the Bible,
he's already released. Okay.
But he was working now on the Old Testament. He'd already released the New Testament. So there was that tussle at that point in time.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. In our next half, we're going to take a short break now. Stay with us. We're going to look at the impact his Bible had on society, the legacy that he had, and what was his death like, and how did the how does his legacy play out in the Church of England, and how does even King Henry VIII change on some of these things? So we're going to delve a little bit into more the end of his life, but stay with us after a break. Thank you.
Lineage is a non-profit organization kept running by generous donors like you. Support us today on patreon.com/lineagejourney.
Lineage Journey not only produces video content, but instructive and illuminating resources to teach young and old about Christian history. Lineage has produced an educational coloring book for people of all ages. It includes original artwork from Ashley Bloom, highlighting the various heroes of the Reformation. Each scene has a matching story, and there are also QR codes to connect you to the website for more information and to watch the videos. There are also fun facts and memorable quotes to accompany the scenes to color in. Designed for young and old alike, get your copy now at lineagejourney.com.
The Reformation is synonymous with men like Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli. When we think of that period of time, it's their names and their stories that leap to mind. But alongside these well-known men are the stories of some inspired and inspiring women. Women who were willing to defy social norms and traditions with a dauntless commitment to God's word. Sisters in Arms is a collection of 8 true stories following the lives of some of the most powerful and influential women of the Reformation. Beginning with the story of Katharina von Bora, a runaway nun and spanning two centuries to take in the story of Marie Durant, an imprisoned Huguenot. These stories are as revolutionary as they are rare. If you haven't already grabbed your copy, you can get one at the Lineage Journey store on our website, lineagejourney.com/shop. Be sure to get yours today.
History shapes identity. Identity shapes mission. And a clear mission determines the trajectory of your future. Knowing where you come from is key to understanding your present purpose and your future mission. Lineage Journey is a series of videos that will take you on a journey through time, discovering the key people and events that have shaped the Christian faith. From the Waldenses to Martin Luther to Zwingli, from England to France, Switzerland to Germany, the light broke over the horizon of Europe, piercing through the Dark Ages, and then spread out over the world. As the United States of America rose to supremacy, Christianity formed the bedrock of this great nation. And so from the Great Awakening to the Great Disappointment and beyond, Lineage follows the journey of God's church throughout time, immersing you in the places, the stories, and the people through whom Christianity has shone the brightest. Join us on a journey through time. Follow us on social media at Lineage Journey, or check out our website at lineagejourney.com.
Welcome back after our short break. We are now going to be looking further into Tyndale's life. In the first half, we looked at where he grew up, what 16th century, 1500 England looked like, what he studied, and how he came about with this burden to translate the Bible, and how he eventually had to leave England to go and live on the continent of Europe. So we mentioned it briefly, but he leaves England. There's this controversy with him and the translation. Where does he initially go, and who should... Does someone shelter him, or is he quite free when he gets there to Europe?
He's free. He goes to Hamburg. Probably from England, goes to Antwerp, and then from there makes his way to Hamburg.
Okay.
I think, and this is, you know, there's some historical evidence for it. Some of it is my personal view, that he goes to Hamburg, goes to Germany, because Luther, by this point, you know, Luther is fairly well established. The Reformation in Germany.
So it's more,
and it was more friendly towards the kind of thing that he wanted to do. So he goes to Hamburg, and he takes with him an assistant, William Roy, because he needs somebody to help him with the linguistics. He would have liked, I think, to have taken John Frith, but he doesn't take Frith with him. He goes with Roy. Roy is his helper. And it was tough going. He, even though Humphrey Monmouth promised to sponsor him, Tyndale was very poor. Now, when I see these two facts, Monmouth promised to sponsor him, but Tyndale was poor and struggling. Mm-hmm. The conclusion that I can come to is that, you know, resourcing a translation of the Bible, the paper, the ink, the books, the rent, the candles, you know, all that amounted to a lot of money, probably more money than Monmouth was able to send. And I think there was also just this sense of Monmouth was not able to send him money regularly, smuggle it out. So he was poor, not so poor that he couldn't resource himself to do the translation, but poor enough that he had to live in shabby lodgings. A lot of the time during winter, he didn't have enough fuel for a fire. And so he
struggled. Do you know what year he moves there, roughly?
Probably around 1524.
Okay, so he's there about 12 years in Europe.
Yes, 1524. Okay. He never went back to England. Yeah. 1524.
So I saw that there's a film called God's Outlaw.
Yes.
Would you think, is that a true description, that he's kind of like on the run?
I think so. I think when you look at the facts, it wasn't like this romanticized idea of King Henry sending people to chase him out of England.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely, he was an outlaw in that he was translating the Bible at a time when it was illegal to do so.
Mm.
He had to leave the country in order to do it. But also, he was then smuggling the Bible back into England.
There's some fascinating stories with that, isn't there? Like how does he gets the Bibles in, smuggling them on ship somehow?
Yes. So before that, now he's in Hamburg, probably around the summer of 1524. The reports vary, but some sources say he left Sodbury Hall in 1523. By the time he leaves for Hamburg, it's 1524.
Okay.
He's in Hamburg, he translates it, and he finds out that in Cologne, there are some really good printers, Quentel and Brickman, and they have warehouses in England, which means that you can smuggle the stuff and store them in England. So he goes to Cologne.
Huh.
By the summer of 1525, he has finished translating it, and he gives Quentel and Brickman the final manuscript. It's a really interesting story. Initially, he wants 6,000 published, 6,000 printed. And then he kind of backpedals and he gets 3,000 printed.
Mm-hmm.
This is now on the press. And while this is on the press, this bishop, Cochlaeus, comes to Cologne.
Mm-hmm.
And Cochlaeus, through various different ways, finds out that there is an Englishman in Cologne translating the Bible into English, and not just translating it, he's going to
print it.
It's gone to print. So Cochlaeus pulls some strings, goes to the Senate, and gets like a cease and desist order. And this is the fun part. He's on his way with the guards from the Senate to Quentel and Brickman's press to seize this mm-hmm. contraband. And Quentel comes and warns Tyndale of what's going to happen. Tyndale runs to the press and grabs one manuscript, shoves it probably in a satchel, and hightails it down to the Rhine with Roy. Cochlaeus comes and confiscates the entire cache of, printed copies of the Bible, confiscates it. Tyndale escapes with just that single Bible. And then he doesn't know where to go. So that he's on the boat and Roy is like, so where are we going to go? And Tyndale is like, we're going to Worms because that's where Luther made his stand and that's where we're going to make our stand.
Wow.
And so he goes to Worms and it turns out that there's a great printer there, Peter Schaeffer, and he gets Schaeffer to print the Bible. And from Worms, they smuggle it from Antwerp and then into England. And they smuggled it in like sometimes in grain sacks. Bales of clothing. They would wrap it in the clothing. And then it would get to some of the main ports in the East. And what they would do is they were call porters that would get those books and then go throughout the Eastern and Northern Shires in the South. And they would sell it from door to door. Yeah.
So the king buys the 3,000 in whatever. Whereabouts does the story pick up where he buys and burns them on the steps of...
That's the bishop.
Oh, that's the... Okay.
That's the Bishop of London. So the Bishop of London also hears about how there's, because there's a continuous... By the summer of 1526, he's printing and smuggling Bibles. So there's this continuous flow. Mm-hmm. The Bishop of London finds out that it's coming to England and he goes to Packington and buys up all the copies and then he burns them. So there's a steady flow of Bibles coming into England from 1526, and people are buying them too. Of course, Bible you've translated is the New Testament.
Yeah.
He starts working on the Old Testament after the New Testament. He never completes it.
Do you know how much of the Old Testament he did? Or
he did quite a bit. I think he was like one or two books short, and he gets Miles Coverdale to help him. And apparently Miles Coverdale was not a good linguist and he did not do a good job of the Old Testament. But it was really Tyndale's New Testament that made a big difference because Tyndale was just a better linguist than Coverdale was.
Mm-hmm. So he goes to Hamburg, then he goes to Cologne,
then he goes to Worms.
Where does he travel anywhere else?
He spends some time in Wittenberg.
Okay.
With Luther. just to, I think, mutual encouragement.
Mm.
And he needed that because by this time, this was, I think, in the 1530s, the king's great matter is afoot. The king hates him. A lot of the English clergy are looking to grab him.
Okay.
And it's really interesting because during the whole debacle with Henry and, you know, Anne, and Henry was wanting to get divorced for quite some time before he married Anne, mm-hmm. and Tyndale had renounced that. Henry had sent agents to Europe to find Tyndale and either arrest him or kill him. So Tyndale was quite depressed. So
now he's aware the king not just doesn't like him, but he's
trying to kill him, right?
He's after him.
Yes, he's after him in the 1530s. And so he goes to Wittenberg. He spends some time in Wittenberg. And while he's in Wittenberg, he also, I think this is probably in the late 1520s. I need to get my timing right because he's in Wittenberg for a prolonged period of time. He meets Luther, but when he's in Wittenberg, he also meets Patrick Hamilton.
Okay.
That's right. So it's, I can't remember off the top of my head when Hamilton was burned, but when Hamilton went to Wittenberg.
He was the first Scottish martyr.
That's right. Yeah. And Tyndale had an impact on Hamilton. One of the reasons that Hamilton went back to Scotland, he was really equipped by Tyndale. So that was all happening during this period between 1526 and 1536. This was some of the movements in Tyndale's life.
1528.
There you go. So it was probably around 1527 that he met him in Wittenberg. Soon after he'd published the Bible in 1526, gotten it out, he went to Wittenberg to spend some time. And this was also when, you know, things were starting to happen with Henry as well.
So how does he finally get caught?
Basically, he is turned in by a friend. This guy made friends with him.
Professed friend.
Right. And turned him over to the authorities. And they arrested him a year before, in 1535, a year before he died. And it's really interesting. But Thomas Cromwell, the king's first minister, was an evangelical. It's really interesting. You can't really tell on the outside what Cromwell was, but Cromwell was an advocate for reform, and Cromwell tried to get him out of prison. And a lot of evangelicals in England kind of went to Cromwell and said, can you do something? But Henry was adamant. He was very angry that Tyndale had dared to renounce his marriage to Anne. And so
it was personal.
Very personal. It was very personal. I mean, the king could have intervened on behalf of his subject, but he didn't. He kind of just was happy for him to be taken.
Would you think it's more personal than it was theological, or whatever you want to call it? Like, at the end, the king's refusal is more to do with his stance about his marriage than it is about his determination to translate the Bible.
Yes.
For sure.
For sure. I think so. I mean, Henry VIII was really interesting. When he started reforming the church, it had nothing to do with the desire for truth. Though, you know, there were times when he talked like that. Sometimes he wrote letters where he spoke about wanting to spiritually nourish his people, or he liked having these theological debates. But the truth is, you have to remember this, in about 1521, Henry wrote a book, a polemic against Luther, and he submitted it to the Pope, for which he was given the golden rose by the Pope. And he was given a name, Fide Defensor, Defender of the Faith.
Wow.
That was Henry VIII. You know, his grandmother was Margaret Beaufort.
So his whole thing about starting a new church has nothing to do with theology. It's all to do with his.
It was primarily
Get a new wife.
Yes, primarily that. He was probably influenced by Anne Boleyn. She was evangelical. She'd picked it up in France. She was at the French court.
Okay.
She brought it back. She was reformist, quite strongly reformist. But Henry, at his core, was a product of his upbringing. And you have to understand, his grandmother was Margaret Beaufort, staunch Catholic woman. And so there was no way that Henry would have turned against the church unless, you know, for any other reason than this. If he had had an heir, he wouldn't have.
Okay. So he dies, or he's martyred, strangled.
And burned.
And then burned. I don't know how you mess up a strangling. Not that I've strangled anyone, but...
No, they did that on purpose. They strangled him and then burned his body. Okay. Like, it wasn't that they...
Couldn't strangle him.
No. No, the pictures, if you look at the woodcuts, like the woodcut pictures, say in Fox's Book of Martyrs, you see him strapped to the stake with the noose around his neck. So I think it's they killed him. It was, maybe it was, it's really interesting when you look at how people were killed during that period of time. In England, there were specific ways that specific people were killed. So I'm wondering whether this was a specific way that martyrs were killed in Antwerp.
Yeah, maybe, maybe. So on his statue that sits in London and overlooks the Thames, there's a plaque and it has, I think, Psalms 119 verse 105. And it also says that his last words were, "Lord, open the eyes of the King of England."
Right.
And then it says, a year after his death, a Bible was placed in every parish around England by order of the king. So
right.
What changes with Henry?
So I think with Henry, he just made the decision to do it. You know, by now he was... You have to understand, right? By 1536 was a nightmare year for Henry. It started off with Catherine of Aragon dying. Then the king, wanting to relive his youth, goes into a joust and is knocked off his horse. And they think he's clinically dead for like 2 or 3 minutes. And so that's a disaster because there's no heir. So they're trying to revive him. Then he has Anne Boleyn beheaded. The first time a queen of England is ever beheaded. And then there's the Pilgrimage of Grey. And then he starts, you know, now he's been dismantling the monasteries. And just prior to that, he'd put out the 10 articles, which basically forbade pilgrimages, forbade all these superstitious, no more celebrating feast days, no more celebrating the rituals of the church, the feast days of the church. And so he was trying to change the church in 1536.
Okay.
And so I think this flowed out of that desire to kind of turn the people away from papistry, which again was ironic, because then a few years later he publishes the 6 articles, which, you know, he wants people to be Catholic, but not too Catholic, just Catholic the way he wants them to be Catholic. And nobody really knew what to believe from one minute to the next with Henry. But I think it was just an accumulation of what was going on at the time. He was really trying to rid England of the Pope. And this was his way of giving people...
There's another way.
Yeah.
Politically motivated, probably.
And that's the thing with the English Reformation. There's two sides to it. There's the celebrated version is, well, Henry did this because he wanted an heir and he was willing to wade through blood to get it. And so he basically kicked out the Pope and started fashioning his own church, which is what the Church of England became. And he did it ad hoc. So, you know, but really that's one aspect of it. The actual English Reformation began with people like Thomas Bilney and
not Henry.
Not really Henry.
Yeah.
But you have these two parallel. And I think that's why a lot of the English Reformation was so politically motivated, because it suddenly became about power as well, rather than just being about doctrine.
What impact does the translation that he does have on the English language or even... And what we speak today.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you pick up a Bible today, King James Version, New King James Version, even English Standard Version, which is a derivative of those two, a lot of it, a large percentage of it is Tyndale's Bible. You know, "O death, where is thy sting?" Words like that. He influenced the English language, you know, probably as much as Shakespeare and Chaucer. Yeah.
More so maybe.
Yeah.
So he dies his lonely death.
Yes.
And I think, you know, like he left England, that doesn't go back. So for 12 years, he's away from home on the continent. This has no family at his death, or there's no funeral or anything like that. And yet he has a legacy with the Bible and all the rest. I don't know. It's like one of those stories where you wonder, like, in the resurrection, will he be shocked and surprised that what his life did accomplish, though he never saw it at the time?
You know what I like about Tyndale? What really inspires me about Tyndale is this. He was a man that, so he experienced God, and then he wanted to share it. And then God gave him a clear calling.
Yeah, I like that. He knows exactly.
That's right. Exactly what God has called him to do. And over the next 12, 13 years of his life, he focuses himself wholeheartedly on accomplishing this calling.
Hmm.
And he does it. And I think that is powerful, you know. It's so hard sometimes to figure out, especially with young people, you want to figure out, what is it that I'm supposed to do? And it's so easy to be wishy-washy. But he wasn't. He knew exactly what God was calling him to do. And then he was like, I'm going to do it. It doesn't matter if I have to suffer. If it doesn't matter if I have to starve. It doesn't matter if I have to be chased across Europe. It doesn't matter if I'm exiled from home or I die for it. I'm going to make my life count for this one thing. And he did. Because the Bible we hold in our hands today,
the heart's back to him.
That's right.
Must have been a genius, really.
Yeah, he was a genius.
Like you said, the King James is largely
Tyndale's
Bible.
Yes.
Copy-paste.
Yes.
The language we speak today has so many
echoes
of Tyndale.
Yes. He was a brilliant linguist.
Yeah, yeah.
Naturally talented. And God used those gifts. It's really cool, right? Like, I mean, when he was at university, he just did an MA, did a BA, did an MA, was thinking about theology, like... And then suddenly his calling was linguistics. And I think it's another thing about gifts, how God gives certain people gifts, right? We're all gifted in some area. The Spirit gives gifts. And Tyndale's gift was being a linguist. And you wouldn't think that, you know, when you're in church, you think, especially when you're in ministry, you think, oh, pastor or teacher, we can narrow the field down to, these are the gifts that the Holy Spirit gives us, you know? But then do you think linguist and how a linguist can then become...
someone who can shape the language.
That's right.
Well, going back to that table discussion where he says, I cause the boy who drives the plow.
That's right.
To know more of the scriptures than you do. And he does it through monosyllabic words.
Yeah.
Like that's his thing. He's just going to pick words that have, as easily as he can, words with one syllable.
Yeah, simply.
To make them simple.
As simple as possible.
But yet it's profound.
That's right.
And
I think that's the power of his genius.
Yeah.
You know, that he was able to take something as powerful as the Bible and then turn it into something so simple that English people could read it. And then, you know, as the reign of Henry VIII progressed and he was an intellectual, he encouraged his nobles to be intellectuals. Mm-hmm. He put the Bible in, all the churches. It was chained to the wall, of course, but you could go in there and read it.
At least you had it.
Yeah. People started to, it's really interesting. People started to become literate so they could read the Bible. So the presence of the Bible drove literacy in England.
Literacy.
Because people realized, oh, there's the Bible. And there's a Bible. By this time, people knew about Luther. People knew about this massive movement of ideas. And that the Bible was the wellspring, the source of those ideas. And so it drove them to learn the language so they could read this book that was changing Europe. It's pretty cool.
So as we kind of draw to a close, just want to make it, what key lesson do you personally draw or you think that our listeners should hear from his life? Like what's the big, big story? What's the big theme or what's the big takeaway from the life of William Tyndale?
I think for me, the lesson from Tyndale summarized in 1 John 1:1-3, you know, where John says, that which we have seen and heard and experienced of the word of life declare we unto you. And ultimately that was Tyndale's life in summary. He experienced Jesus through the Bible and then he dedicated his life
to share that with others.
Through the gifts God had given him. I really like that, you know. We're not all the same. And yet God has given us that same calling. Make me known.
And
you can use your gifts to make him known.
Amen. Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being with us. And those of you who are listening or watching, we pray that this podcast into the life of William Tyndale has enlightened you and giving you some insight into who this man was and what an impact he still has today. And may we live lives that make a similar impact on the world around us, but also understand what our purpose is and that our purpose is bigger than our life. Thank you for joining us. May God bless you. If you want more information, please go to www.lineagejourney.com, where you can see our videos, read our articles on the website, find some of our resources there, and see some of the other podcasts we've done on other episodes of Christian History. Thank you and God bless.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Lineage Journey is supported by your generous donations. Did you know that you can donate on a monthly basis? Any amount, from $2 to $100 or whatever you decide, through patreon.com/lineagejourney. Your donations go towards the cost of producing our varied content, and we thank you for your support.